And a good Wednesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Want to thank the Law Group this morning for their continued support of the show. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. We'll have more from them coming up a little bit later on in the program. Really kind of all over the place this morning. A lot going on both here across the United States and internationally this morning. We'll kind of start off where we left yesterday as the votes continued in the United States Senate. Yesterday afternoon, it was official. Trump's big, beautiful bill did pass reconciliation in a 51-50 vote. That tie-breaking vote cast by the vice president and J.D. Vance. This is how that moment unfolded on the floor of the United States Senate yesterday afternoon.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being evenly divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative. The bill as amended is passed.
And so there you have it. That was J.D. Vance reading it out. Some Republican senators clapping in the chamber after more than 24 hours of debate over the legislation that was heavily modified. The House original House version of the Big Beautiful Bill sent over the Senate, heavily modified by them, but it did pass in that 51-50 vote. Three GOP senators voting no. We talked about the math yesterday morning. Those were Susan Collins out of Maine, Tom Tillis out of North Carolina, and Rand Paul out of Kentucky, the three no votes on this legislation. With the passage in the Senate, that bill now makes its way back to the United States House, where the House Rules Committee yesterday met for nearly 12 hours debating the legislation, where it did officially move forward out of the House Rules Committee and now will head to the full House chamber for consideration. The problem that we're going to have in the House with this legislation is that there are several Republicans that have already made the point that they are concerned with various aspects of the measure. Just two Republicans voted against reporting the bill out of committees: Representative Ralph Norman out of South Carolina and Chip Roy out of Texas, voting against this bill in the Rules Committee. And I guess I'll just kind of lay out the Rules Committee. We've got a similar setup here in North Carolina. The Rules Committee is the last stop before something makes its way to the floor or doesn't make its way to the floor. Lots of pieces of legislation die in the Rules Committee, and lots of pieces of legislation move forward in the Rules Committee. It is the final last step before something is brought, at least here in North Carolina, end up in Congress. It is the last step before something is brought to the entire chamber for a vote. It did, in fact, receive that favorable report. As you can imagine, no Democrats on the House Rules Committee voted to advance it, while the remaining seven Republicans did, in fact, vote in favor. The majority of Republicans on that committee appear that they were sympathetic to the legislation, wanted to move forward with it, and that is exactly what they're doing. One of the individuals, Chip Roy, who, according to this Fox reporting, did not vote in favor of it. He was on with Jesse Kelly, his radio and TV show, yesterday. And I think it's important. I mean, this is running up against the deadline here. It's July the 2nd. President Donald Trump said he wants this bill on his desk. The House is going to have the opportunity to modify this legislation today. It will have to make its way back to the Senate for yet another round of confirmation if the House makes any significant or substantial changes. So what are some of the concerns from the members of Congress? Now, Chip Roy is one of them. He was on with Jesse Kelly yesterday. Let's take a listen.
We want to be with the president to deliver a bill that will, you know, make tax cuts permanent, make sure that more money's in all our pockets, help all the working class Americans, get the border funding needed for ICE to undo all the damage of Biden, all of those things that we know are important. But remember, I set out 6 months ago, I got the Freedom Caucus to lead into it and say, guys, we should do two separate bills. The first bill should just take care of what the president wants to do on the debt ceiling, take care of what the president wants to do on the border and defense, and move forward quickly so we can get something done. Well, they wanted to do a big, beautiful bill. Well, here we are, and I agree with you. Nothing big is ever going to be beautiful in this town. And so what we've got is a bill that has some good things in it. We fought for in the House. A couple of things in the Senate that were actually not bad. Rick Scott, Mike Lee, Rand Paul, and Ron Johnson have been out there fighting the good fight. But mostly what we have is a traditional massive bill that will have significant amount of deficit spending. No matter what the administration says, no matter what my colleagues in the House and the Senate say, we've got objective friends who are economists, budget people, who worked for Trump, who are with us. We want to deliver, but the math's just not there. The deficits in the first 5 years are huge. It has significant problems in the bill. And what they just passed, I mean, I can't even say this out loud without getting fuming mad. They basically gave a big giveaway to the moderates that gutted most of our work to repeal and terminate the Green New Scam. I mean, you can't even make it up. The president said terminated. We terminated like 60% of it in the House. I think they just gutted it. And now we terminate maybe 30 or 40% of it at max. And by the way, we're going to continue to provide Medicaid to illegal aliens. We're going to continue to have taxpayer funding go to transgender surgeries, including kids. We only restrict Planned Parenthood funding for the first year, not for 10 years. And there are problem after problem. They created a new $50 billion rural hospital fund. They created a new radiation exposure fund that they say will only be $6 billion, but everybody I talk to will be $200 billion. Look, I don't know how to put it. The swamp is going to swamp. And if the administration isn't willing to lean on everybody and say, end this crazy, then why am I on the hook to vote for a bill just so I can get some tax cuts and border, which is what I want, but I don't want all the spending? Here we are.
So there's the arguments there made by Chip Roy as he lays out some of his concerns, some of his issues with the legislation. And you know, he brings up the Green New Scam, the Green New Deal. And he's absolutely spot on with that. I caught this article yesterday afternoon over at Politico. And the headline is a pretty shocking one. Final Senate mega bill to ease wind and solar phase out. So easing the phase out, meaning that it is not happening as quickly as it was originally called for by the president, as it was originally passed by the United States House back when this bill, you know, started off and was drafted and debated for many months in the House. And it reads as follows. Senate Republicans intended to remove a controversial tax on solar and wind energy projects as part of their budget mega bill, according to three people familiar with the plans. Republicans' final amendment to wrap in last minute changes to the budget reconciliation bill will include a compromise for Senate holdouts by removing the tax, as well as providing a carve out from the tax credit phase out for solar and wind projects that begin construction less than 1 year after the bill's enactment, according to three people who were granted anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. The amendment would still require other solar and wind energy projects to be placed in service by the end of 2027, echoing language in the Senate's updated text last week that could threaten hundreds of planned projects. It would also make changes to complex requirements that prohibit sourcing from foreign entities of concerns that companies had seen as unworkable. The approach marks a potential compromise between GOP camps of senators who were divided on the phase-out for credits, including Senator Lisa Murkowski, a key swing vote. And all of the reporting that I have read, all of the different analysis that I've seen throughout the day yesterday and into the early parts of this morning indicated that Lisa Murkowski essentially was the reason that these changes have been made in the Senate proposal as it relates to solar and wind tax credits and some of the phase outs that were anticipated there, that she was the one. And you know, this comes down to what politics are. You need the number of votes to support it. And for Senate Republicans, I guess they rather would have had the vote pass than not pass at making some of these changes to these solar subsidies, these green energy tax credits that we all know are incredibly disastrous and incredibly damning. You've got the federal government that is trying to pick winners and losers on what everybody agrees, except for those on the far left that think that somehow solar and wind are going to solve all of our problems. Everybody else agrees that while wind and solar have some level to play in energy, they are not the solution going forward. I talked about this a lot back when I was on the radio here in Wilmington. This was a consistent thread and a consistent topic on the show. When you look at what, for example, what is described as baseload power, which is the minimum amount of electricity that needs to be generated as a baseload, right? Everybody's house has refrigerators and air conditioning and heat and appliances that are constantly plugged in and constantly sucking off the grid, lights, so on and so forth. You've got this base load power that needs to be met. You need to do that with what is called a dispatchable form of energy, something that you can ramp up and then ramp down based on what that base load is. That's why things like coal, that's why things like natural gas, things like nuclear can be spun up and spun down and changed to meet those demands. You do not have that luxury with solar and wind. It just doesn't exist. If the sun is shining, the panels generate electricity. If it's cloudy, they still generate electricity, but it's not anywhere near as much as if it's sunny outside. When it's the middle of the night, solar panels are generating no electricity whatsoever. It is not a dispatchable form of energy. It is inherently, based on the technology, incredibly unreliable. That doesn't mean that it's stupid. That doesn't mean that it's a bad source of energy. It just means that you can't replace nuclear, coal, steam, which is a byproduct of natural gas. You can't replace those forms of energy that are inherently reliable with something like wind and solar. This has been a big issue across the state of North Carolina. This is a big issue nationally. These forms of energy are not reliable. And again, doesn't mean that they're not useful. It doesn't mean that they don't have their place. But inherently, just based on how they work, how they operate, they are by definition unreliable forms, unreliable sources of energy. If it's not windy outside and there's not enough wind that is going through wind turbines, it doesn't generate enough electricity. And there's nothing you can do to change that. You can't make it windier. You can't make the sun shine more. You can't make it not cloudy. Right? You don't have a choice. You don't have an option whether those conditions exist or not. And that's why these tax credits and the government subsidies of these forms of energy, I believe, is setting up the United States, and in the case of North Carolina with the Carolina Carbon Plan, are setting up our state and our nation for ruin. And I don't say that lightly. If you look at what folks on the left want to do, which is cut down on CO2 emissions. They want to stop global warming, stop climate change. They want to do that by replacing essentially every other dispatchable form of energy with solar panels made in China and wind turbines made in China. That's their solution to America's energy sustainability going forward. Anybody with any rational thought can clearly see and clearly understand why that is not a viable path forward. That is not a sustainable energy policy for the United States. And so I've got this article from the Economic Policy Innovation Center. It says, and it's talking about the House's, the Senate's revision to this, and it reads, most of the green energy tax credits were set to fully phase out between 2032 and the point at which greenhouse gases drop below 25% of the 2022 level. In the bill that passed the House, conservatives secured earlier and earlier phase-out deadlines for most credits and requirements that projects seeking to qualify for the investment tax credit, the ITC, and the production tax credit, the PTC, must be constructed within 60 days of enactment and be placed in service before December the 31st of 2028. The ITC and PTC have primarily been used by wind and solar developers since beginning construction within 60 days is a difficult task. Those two forms of energy production would have been most impacted by the new requirement. But it goes on to say, in contrast, the Senate-passed version of the One Big Beautiful Bill undermines these safeguards. The Senate bill includes a 2027 placed in service deadline for wind and solar projects seeking to qualify for the ITC and PTC. However, there is an exemption. Wind and solar projects that begin construction within the next 12 months are not subject to the placed in service requirement, and those developers can still collect subsidies for up to 4 years while they finish construction and collect another 10 years of subsidies once they place the project into service. So you've got right there 14 years of potential subsidies. To fulfill the construction requirements, all a wind and solar developer must do is either break ground on the site in question or incur at least 5% of the total cost of the facility and receive the components purchased. One or the other must occur within the 12-month window to qualify the project for this exemption from the placed-in-service requirement. Once qualified, the developer has 4 years to place that project into service and begin production and begin delivering electricity. And it goes into giving an example. A solar developer can break ground on a project in June of 2026 and qualify for the PTC delay, placing the project into service for 4 years, and then collect 10 more years worth of subsidies. This means that locking in these subsidies through 2040 would be the case for a project that follows that path. Wind and solar are two of the most problematic sources of energy for a reliable energy grid. Solar and wind are non-dispatchable energy sources, which means that they can provide too much or too little energy depending on extreme conditions, for example, weather. Americans shouldn't have to see their tax dollars used to subsidize the destruction of their own power grid. Instead, Congress should ensure that this loophole is closed. At a minimum, wind and solar projects seeking these tax credits should be required to meet the 2027 placed-in-service deadline to receive taxpayer subsidies. So all of that said, all of that being laid out here, the report from Sarah Wagner over at the Economic Policy and Innovation Center lays out exactly the argument that you just heard from Chip Roy. And now again, we're looking at one small piece of this big, beautiful bill that the Senate officially voted on yesterday and approved in a 51-50 vote, with Vice President J.D. Vance casting the tie-breaking vote, Susan Collins, Tom Tillis, and Rand Paul all voting against that legislation. However, the VP was able to cast that tie-breaking vote. And to me, this is incredibly concerning. It appears that the House had the right idea, but all rumors, all rumblings on social media and inside reports seem to indicate that Lisa Murkowski was not going to vote for this legislation, and her big holdout was these two credits: the investment tax credit and the production tax credit that is being used by the vast majority of the solar and wind industry. And Republicans, I guess, in the John Thune, the leader of the United States Senate, I guess, thought that it was better to pass it with this modification than have the bill fail completely. However, as we look at the math in the United States House, you're going to be running into the same problem. You're going to be running into the exact same issue in the United States House coming up just a little bit later on today when lawmakers make their way to the floor and begin the process of debating and likely trying to make significant modifications to the big, beautiful bill. So that's going to come down and will take place a little bit later on in the day today, as Republicans in the House debate what many believe are some serious problems with the legislation. Like, for example, just the one thing that we looked at this morning, these additional tax credits and this ongoing government subsidy of inherently unreliable forms of energy. I don't know any other way to say it. I don't know how you can describe it in a way that makes any more sense than that. Now, I'm not saying that wind and solar don't have their place. I'm not saying that wind and solar are not forms of technology, forms of energy that have a use case. I strongly believe that they do. I believe the technology is very cool and very fascinating. But I also don't believe that the government should be in the business of subsidizing, which is exactly what these tax credits do, subsidizing the construction of wind and solar. And you've all heard the debate. Well, these projects are just too expensive. Well, if they're too expensive, then they're not practical. I mean, that's what it comes down to. If the federal government or a state government has to subsidize something to happen, it probably shouldn't happen in the first place. And that this just goes back to basic tenets of conservatism. It goes back to the basic tenets of free market capitalism. If developers can't build a solar array, if developers can't build a wind farm off the coast without getting the subsidies from the federal government, if it's not economically viable or economically feasible for them to do it without handouts from the federal government, then I will make the argument time and time again that those projects just don't make sense. That we should not be involved in those things if they can't exist without the government coming in and essentially handing people free money. I will 100% of the time object and call that out. It's no different than the EV vehicle subsidies that have existed over the last couple of years, where you had the federal government giving people thousands of dollars worth of tax breaks for going out and buying an electric car. Why? If the cars are so great, if the technology is so awesome, if these cars are the most unbelievable thing that has ever taken place and everybody is going to own one and everybody needs to own one, then let the free market figure it out. Let consumers go out and buy those cars without getting a $9,000 tax break from the federal government, without them getting thousands of dollars worth of tax breaks from their local state or their municipality. It just doesn't make any sense to me. The federal government and state governments should not be in the business of picking winners or losers. They should not be in the business of choosing which form of energy succeeds, which kind of cars people are buying. That is undoubtedly never, and I mean never, the role of government. We live in a free market society, at least for the most part, I believe that we do. Part of capitalism, part of the free market that we live in, is allowing businesses to win and lose, but giving them the opportunity to do that. Not having the federal government put its thumb on the scale and choose which facilities, which kind of cars, which sort of this or that succeeds or doesn't succeed. I am inherently against this. And while I'm not the biggest fan in the world of Chip Roy, the point that he made in that clip back a few minutes ago, I think is absolutely spot on. President Donald Trump has called it the Green New Scam. Christ, it was a big part of his campaign consistently, and talking about the Green New Deal, talking about wind and solar, and now you've got Republican senators in D.C. that have allowed and will allow this process to unfold potentially until 2040, giving subsidies to these companies that are putting these wind and solar farms online. So a little bit as to what we are expecting coming up today. Chad Pergam, who works for Fox News, was on the Jesse Waters show last night, describing what this process is going to look like unfolding in the House and how this is all going to come down. Let's take a listen to this.
Big beautiful bill narrowly passed the Senate after J.D. Vance broke the 50-50 tie. Now it heads back to the House. Senior congressional correspondent Chad Pergam joins us now. Hey, Chad.
Charlie, good evening. As hard as it was to move this through the Senate, it may be tougher in the House. House Republicans want to support President Trump, but they don't like getting jammed by the Senate. A test vote comes tomorrow in the House.
The speaker has made it clear that he wants to pass this bill in the House and get it to the president's desk by Friday. So there's certainly time to do that. But the speaker has said we're going to be voting on the rule tomorrow morning. And after we vote on the rule, we're going to be voting on the bill. So if there's members that don't vote for that rule, then there's going to have to be negotiations.
A House-Senate negotiation would extend the process for weeks. Conservatives oppose what they say is too much spending in the bill. Some Republicans contend that GOP senators used an accounting stunt to claim their bill did not add to the deficit.
That problem is just simple arithmetic. My colleagues in the Senate failed us. My colleagues in the Senate failed us. They sent us a bill knowingly, using a policy baseline gimmick.
It comes down to the power of persuasion. Can President Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson convince reluctant members to support the Senate bill? It differs from the plan the House adopted in May.
We have members across the conference who have concerns about various provisions of the bill. A lot of people didn't get what they wanted. They didn't think some savings went as far as they should have gone, or that maybe some of the cuts went too far.
It's about the math. The House can only lose 3 votes and still pass the bill. Also, Republicans may struggle to get all of their members to the Capitol tomorrow. Bad weather is delaying flights to D.C. That could jeopardize the July 4th deadline.
So that was Chad Pergam last night on Jesse Waterso. Charlie Hurt filling in for Jesse, kind of walking through and describing how that process is set to unfold a little bit later on today. And we will, of course, be keeping a very close eye on what some of that looks like. And right there at the end of the report, you heard Chad Pergam mention some issues with individuals struggling to get to D.C. There was a couple of lawmakers yesterday posting on X on their social media platforms that they were, in fact, dealing with some of those same issues, that they did not have the ability to travel. I saw a couple of members from South Carolina saying they couldn't get a single flight into D.C. Presumably, they rented some cars and drove up anyway, as bad weather has caused major flight issues across the East Coast over the last couple of days. So that is going to be an interesting process to watch unfold today. And with all of that, we will continue to follow it and see exactly what the United States House does. Speaker Mike Johnson, I do not envy his position at all. Trump is pushing hard for this bill. You've got Speaker Mike Johnson pushing hard for the legislation as well. Trump sees it as a keystone of his campaign and a keystone of his administration to get this passed by the July 4th deadline. If I was gambling on it this morning, and actually, you know, we can gamble on it this morning. I'll go over to Poly Markets and see if there is a line on this being passed. It doesn't. Here we go. Here is some of the betting odds, the betting lines on this being passed. Oh, actually, that was the reconciliation bill in the Senate. I'm not seeing anything necessarily on the House, but with as many holdouts as there's likely to be over some of these changes, the deficit spending that you heard about, some of the changes to the green energy tax subsidies, some of that stuff being in the legislation is going to be a very tough hurdle for lawmakers in the United States House. It's going to be a tough hurdle for House Speaker Mike Johnson to deal with coming up a little bit later on today. And essentially, these are the options. There's essentially 3 things that can happen. Now that it's in this, now that it's passed the Senate, the question is what will happen in the House. It can either pass without any changes, so it doesn't have to go through the Senate again. If the House just rubber stamps it this morning or later today and says, we love it, it goes to the president's desk, it's done. If there are changes in the House, it will go. Will have to go back to the Senate. The question would be, does the Senate just immediately concur with those changes, or do we set up a process again where we watch days and hours of reading of the entire bill and watch this process go forward? Or that it just goes so far that House members do not vote in favor of it at all, and it dies in the United States House. Those are the three options that are ahead in House Speaker Mike Johnson, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, and others are going to be struggling with, likely dealing with that in the overnight hours, and we'll be dealing with that a little bit later on today. It's not immediately clear to me when these individuals are expected to be back in the House. I know it's happening at some point this morning. As it stands, it looks like the House is set to meet at 9 a.m. for legislative business and will begin debate on the Senate agreement of the Big Beautiful Bill. So that is going to happen sometime around 9 o'clock this morning. We'll continue to track those details right here on the Nick Craig Show. I want to thank the law group for their support and tell you a little bit about them this morning. When legal challenges arise, make sure you put your trust in the law group right here in Wilmington. For over 20 years, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across the eastern half of our state. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong defense, the law group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. Great news, ladies and gentlemen. They're located in downtown Wilmington and just a simple phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. That's 910-251-6088, or their website, lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. Appreciate their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. On the other side, we've got some international news unfolding this morning as President Donald Trump says Israel has agreed to a Gaza ceasefire deal. We'll provide the latest details on that coming up as the Nick Craig Show rolls on, streaming live on a Wednesday morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, live on a Wednesday morning, 4th of July week. Had a great time last night on our Patreon hangout. We do those once a month for those that support the show financially over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Obviously, a large piece of the discussion last night was the major political news over the weekend that U.S. Senator Tom Tillis announced that he is not running for re-election, leaving an open seat here in North Carolina. That was available to our Patreon members over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. We'll do it again coming up here in just a couple of weeks at the end of July, and look forward to talking with everybody again. You can get access to that, daily show notes, and more by supporting the show over at Patreon. Before we get into some of the ceasefire talk of this morning, kind of continuing the thread on this Tillis discussion, President Donald Trump was asked about this on Air Force One yesterday. This is what the president had to say.
I didn't get along with Tillis, and he resigned. That's good. That's a good thing. Somebody that would really be great is Laura. She grew up there. But they live in Florida and they have a very good life, and they, you know, they're great people. She did fantastically running the RNC. She's even got a show that's, it's like the number one show, and Mark Levin is likewise. I mean, they have the number one, number two show over the weekend. So she's done well. She's a great person, Laura Trump. I mean, that would always be my first choice, but she doesn't live there now. But she's there all the time, her parents are there. You know, she really knows North Carolina well, and I won it three times. I don't know who the candidates are going to be. I think you're going to have one of the congressmen step up and should do very well.
So is she talking about it?
No, not at all. It's so soon. I had it out with this guy two nights ago, and he resigned, you know, which I was happy about. He did us all a favor.
So a couple of kind of interesting things in there, kind of reading in between the tea leaves on Trump's comments. He obviously says, you know, my daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, you know, would be a great pick for this. She'd be a great person for that position. But then also later on saying, oh, I assume one of the congressmen are probably going to jump into that race. seemingly indicating he has not yet had a conversation with his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, who, of course, is a Wrightsville Beach native, grew up here in southeastern North Carolina as before she married Eric Trump and took the Trump last name. A Wilmington native, did spend a lot of time here in North Carolina during the last campaign cycle. I've had the opportunity to chat with her. She joined me a couple of times on the radio show back a couple of years ago. Trump says that she'd be a great pick, but makes the point. She lives in Florida. She's had a kind of really great life. She's got young kids. And that really is kind of the question this morning as we look at this open U.S. Senate seat. Does she want this position? And we talked about this last night on our Patreon hangout for the month. And I made the point that I think she'd be crazy to run for it. Not because she'd be a bad pick, not because she'd be a bad senator, but she's got a great life down there in Florida. Why would she want to come back to North Carolina? Being in North Carolina is not the problem, but why would she want to move back to North Carolina to run in what is likely to be the most expensive United States Senate race that has ever taken place in our country? That is an incredible amount of stress and pressure for somebody. Is she capable of it? I think absolutely. Could she win? Absolutely. The question is, does she want to put herself in that position? My gut reaction to that is no. She had the opportunity to take over Marco Rubio's seat in Florida, where she is a resident. She punted that opportunity, not wanting to join the United States Senate. With that, and obviously things change, circumstances change, times change. I just can't imagine that she would really, truly be interested in this seat. The president saying, oh, she'd be my number one pick, but maybe one of the congressmen from North Carolina will do so. Many names have been floated out there. Pat Harrigan, Richard Hudson, Greg Murphy, some of those Republican names have been floated out there for a potential run in this. Regardless of who ends up running, it's going to obviously be incumbent for them to get the backing and the support of the president in Donald Trump for that primary race. And then it will be an all-out blitz to the general election as we still patiently wait to see whether former Democrat Governor Roy Cooper decides whether or not he wants to be in that position. Not immediately clear if that's going to happen, when that is going to happen. That could obviously change the circumstances pretty heavily. So we'll continue to track those details. And the commentary there from President Donald Trump and some of that other information and see exactly how this unfolds. Probably into the latter parts of July, we will, I would imagine as we get to the latter parts of July, maybe the first week or two of August, we will have a better idea as to what a race like this will look like. I would imagine by that point, you will have pretty significant lines drawn in the sand as to who is actually going to run for this and who those candidates are going to be. We'll keep an eye on the details right here on the Nick Craig Show. Turning to some international news this morning, President Donald Trump said yesterday in a Truth Social post that Israel has accepted his administration's proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza and that Hamas should take the deal. Trump said this in this post on Truth Social. My representatives have had a long and productive meeting with the Israelis today on Gaza. Israel has agreed to the necessary conditions to finalize the 60-day ceasefire, during which time we will work with all parties to end the war, the Qataris and the Egyptians, who have worked very hard to help bring peace, will deliver this final proposal. I hope for the good of the Middle East that Hamas takes the deal, because it will not get better. It will only get worse. And ending his post with his new catchphrase, thank you for your attention to this matter. White House officials had met this week with former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, who serves as Israel's strategic affairs minister and advises Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on foreign policy. Israel and the U.S. are also said to be working on a comprehensive peace proposal that will not only end the war, but see the return of as many as 50 remaining hostages. 30 are already expected to have already died. 20 apparently still living, as well as a broader regional peace negotiation. Netanyahu has been preparing his public for peace, and more Israelis are speaking out about the need to end the war, which has lasted since Hamas invaded Israel and murdered more than 1,200 people back on October the 7th, 2023. Hamas is the sticking point. To this point, it has refused previous ceasefire proposals because it does not want to agree to be removed from power and wants to continue enjoying the leverage that its Israeli hostages have given them. If Hamas refuses, it is likely that Israel will continue its bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Most of that has already been essentially leveled. Something like 90% of the buildings have been destroyed. The road networks are non-existent. I mean, the Gaza Strip, there's really not a whole hell of a lot there after Israel has bombarded it now for over a year and a half. So there's not necessarily a whole lot to even hang on to there. Trump also announced that this announcement, this major deal, could come as soon as Monday. Benjamin Netanyahu is due to be in Washington early next week for meetings, and that ceasefire deal could come forward as early as next week. So the president, again, continuing to try and make peace on a variety of different fronts, so many different issues that are taking place both here in the country and internationally, where the president continues to advocate for deals, peace negotiations, and various compromises by all different parties involved. You know, with this situation unfolding, of course, in Gaza, you had over the last couple of weeks the situation in Iran. It is still truly remarkable to me that the president is still, with everything that has been said, everything that has been done, is still advocating for peace. But I will note, you know, the big wild card in all of this continues to be Israel. I mean, you saw on last week, we brought you the audio live as it happened here on the Nick Craig Show. 12 hours after President Donald Trump announces the ceasefire deal between Israel and Iran, Israel, for whatever stupid freaking reason, decides that they're going to go into yet again another all-out offensive blitz with airstrikes over Iran. Trump walking to Air Force or to the helicopter to fly over to Joint Base Andrews said that, you know, Israel and Iran don't know what the F they're doing. Called out Benjamin Netanyahu, I presume, then got on the phone and ripped him a new one over those continued airstrikes, very aggressive airstrikes, after this announcement had been made. That continues to be a major problem for the president. And the question really comes down to, and it's not a dissimilar question from that's being asked about the Russia and Ukraine war. Does Israel really want peace in those regions? Or they say they do. They say they want the war to end. But are they willing to actually sign on the dotted line of a ceasefire deal and no longer conduct attacks? That remains to be unseen. And I think there's very similar parallels between Russia and Ukraine. Russia doesn't want to be in this war anymore. Russia's young men are being slaughtered on the front lines. They have no interest, but they're not actually interested in peace. They can say it. They can project that's what they want. But when the olive branch is extended, when the opportunity to actually move forward with peace, move forward with a ceasefire deal is proposed, you've got the various parties that back out from it. And I'm not necessarily sure this morning if Israel is actually interested in a ceasefire deal in Hamas, same way that I'm not exactly sure if they were interested in a ceasefire deal with Iran, right? Is it more than the ceasefire? Do they want regime change? Is it the ceasefire, or do they want to not necessarily occupy, but control the government that exists in the Gaza Strip, control the government that exists in Iran? But those are two very different things. And when we talk about things like regime change, which the president has gotten himself in some hot water with those on the right over the last couple of weeks, I will continue to contend and continue to stand by the fact that the United States should not be involved in those kind of activities. It does not benefit the United States. You can look at all of the examples of regime change in the Middle East over the last 30 or 40 years. Arguably, none of them have worked successfully. Because what ends up happening is you get a vacuum that takes place. Somehow worse individuals end up seizing power, and then you are in a much worse situation than you were even before. And that's my big concern with the Iranian agreement that, you know, the Iranian deal itself is fine. The question is, where do things go from there? Because Israel seems to be hell-bent on making sure that the supreme leader, the Ayatollah, is no longer in power. And I'm of the mindset that they want the United States to do their dirty work on it, which I'm just not a fan of. And I'm not going to be in favor of, and I'm not going to support. I think it's detrimental to the United States. It is not serving America's best interests to affect regime change. And it leads the United States into another situation where we're having to clean up the mess of our allies throughout the rest of the world. And that's just, it's not something that I support. It's not something that I'm in favor of. I'm also not in the favor of the Iranian government, the Ayatollah, having access to nuclear weapons. But there's got to be some sort of middle road, some sort of crossing or passing there in the middle where you can do both without completely overthrowing the government and affecting regime change, which, as we know, historically, over the last 40 or 50 years, has not worked. It just hasn't. There is example after example after example of terror cells, whether it's ISIS or other groups, taking control of government after the United States thinks it's a good idea to affect regime change. After the United States, you know, drone strikes a leader or kills some leader. So that is one of the things that we are tracking this morning as well. Announcement could be coming as early as next week. We'll continue to track those details and continue to watch how all of that is set to unfold. And with that, you've got an announcement from the United States yesterday that there will be a pause on some weapon transfers to Ukraine as we continue with international conflict. The White House said yesterday that President Trump has paused the delivery of some air defense interceptors and precision-guided bombs and missiles to Ukraine, citing Pentagon concerns that the U.S. weapon stocks were dwindling too low. Included among the munitions being halted are interceptors for Patriot air defense systems, precision artillery rounds, and missiles that the Ukrainian Air Force fires from American-made F-16 jets, according to Pentagon officials. They had been critical weapons in Ukraine's efforts to hold off increasingly intense attacks from Russia at a particularly perilous moment in the 3 year and 4 months since Russia invaded. It was unclear exactly how many weapons were included or how quickly the effect of the pause would be felt on the battleground, though some U.S. officials said on Tuesday that the munitions were not scheduled to be shipped to Ukraine for several months. Only last week, after meeting with President Vladimir Zelensky on the sidelines of a NATO meeting in the Netherlands, President Trump said he was open to selling more weapons to Ukraine, but by that time, the pause was already being planned at the Pentagon. Administration officials said yesterday that the reason for the delay was a concern over shortages of ammunition and air defense that the United States or allies might need to deal with far-flung as many global issues continue to partake. Some of those systems were scheduled for delivery to Ukraine over the next year or so, but many on the left, including the president of Ukraine, said that this is a signal to Vladimir Putin that the United States is gradually getting out of its role as Ukraine's major supplier of advanced weaponry. That in turn may encourage the Russian president to drag out talks about a ceasefire, figuring that Ukraine forces may soon be starved of ammunition and anti-missile systems. Anna Kelly, a White House spokeswoman, said in a statement, quote, "This decision was made to put America's interests first following a DOD review of our nation's military support and assistance to other countries across the globe. The strength of the United States armed forces remains unquestioned. Just ask Iran." The move seemed to represent a victory for Vice President J.D. Vance and other officials who have long questioned the value of American support for Ukraine, which is, of course, not a NATO ally. When the war began, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, then still a senator, ranked among the strongest supporters for arming Ukraine. So that is the latest that we are tracking over there this morning. Zelensky doing his trick and pony show yesterday after this announcement, you know, pleading to the United States to continue to fund this forever war that, again, seemingly has no end in sight. And so we'll see if Trump changes tune on this, or if this DOD review and some of the, I guess you would say, data coming out of the DOD with what the munitions stockpile, how much ammo we have left, whether that holds and whether the president stays on that, and to see if Russia decides that they're going to not necessarily retaliate, but respond to this and drag out some of those peace talks. Because again, the reality is I don't think Russia wants peace. Again, they claim that they do. They claim that they'll come to the table and negotiate, but I'm not sure that I actually believe that that's the case. I really haven't seen much evidence of them actually wanting peace. It seems more as they're interested in continuing the war because, well, they want to take over Ukraine and have that back as part of the motherland, as part of Russian territory. So still very much a fluid situation. We'll continue to track the details right here on the Nick Craig Show. Well, we are expecting a busy day in the United States House. We'll be tracking those details throughout the day and keep you updated right here. Want to thank the Law Group again for their continued support. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. I will be filling in for Vince Coakley on a Wednesday morning, coming up here in just a couple of hours, 10 to noon on WBT. Hopefully you'll join me for that. If not, we're back tomorrow morning right here on the Nick Craig Show.